Here's one fallout from the financial crisis and the recession. Last year, nearly 3 million people started drawing Social Security retirement benefits. That's a lot more than government numbers crunchers expected. And it's because many older workers who lost their jobs have been unemployed so long, they're turning to Social Security earlier than planned. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Jan Dolan is a school psychologist. At least she was until about 10 months ago when she was laid off. She says she's applied for dozens of jobs, even those requiring far less education.
I had actually applied to a daycare center, and this woman called me, the director of the daycare center, and ended up telling me that, you know, I wasn't qualified for the job.
She had always planned to keep working.
I really wanted to work until 70, which gives you a significant amount, you know, of more money. I'd obviously already be on Medicare and contributing.
Contributing, as in she still feels she has more to give to school kids who could use her help and wisdom. But Dolan's plans have run up against a reality many older Americans are facing. At 63 years old, Dolan is uninsured, and her unemployment checks will run out soon. So, running out of options, she visited her local Social Security office.
I just never, ever intended to take early retirement. For, you know, for a lot of reasons. For, you know, financial reasons. And it just was not my idea of what I wanted to do. And it still is not my idea.
For most, the full retirement age is currently 66. But people can start drawing Social Security as early as 62. Drawing early, however, cuts monthly payments. Alicia Munell is director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College.
One of the most powerful things you can do to have a secure retirement is to work longer. If you can claim your Social Security benefits at full retirement age instead of 62, you'd just be so much better off.
Social Security had predicted there would be a 15% increase in retirement applications last year due to the arrival of the baby boom. Instead, the increase was 20%.
So that's 5 percentage points more, or one-third more than we originally forecasted as an increase. That's a significant amount.
Jason Fichtner is chief economist at the Social Security Administration. He says you might expect fewer people to retire early after the beating so many 401ks took when the markets crashed.
We also see that there are those people who, at age 62 or 63, might have lost their jobs and find it harder to find new employment and decide to take retirement benefits earlier. And on net, right now, there seems to be more people filing for early benefits than delaying.
Just to be clear, these early filings won't affect the long-term health of Social Security, because over a lifetime, the payouts are actuarially the same. And another thing, just because someone starts drawing Social Security doesn't mean they should give up on finding work, says Jean Setzfund, the director of financial security at AARP.
Tap into Social Security, continue to look for a job. Once you find the job, stop taking Social Security. You can either pay it back and or just stop and then continue to build your credits so that you can build up for a higher benefit.
In other words, if you decide to file for Social Security early, you still have options. So don't assume that just because you've received a few checks, you're locked into lower payments for life. Bob Daly is hoping to get back into the workforce, even though he started drawing Social Security right when he turned 62.
You know, I'd still rather be working. Is basically what it comes down to.
He was laid off from his job in international logistics about a year ago and needed the Social Security checks to help pay the bills. He's still looking for jobs in his field, forcing himself to get on the computer every day and search the job boards.
I believe it's going to happen. You know, if not, you know, c'est la vie. But, you know, I truly believe that it will happen, that I can stand there and say, thank you very much, Uncle Sam, but I'll wait a little longer.
And Social Security would be happy to suspend the payments. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
We turn now to American finance. Federal Reserve officials wrap up a two-day meeting today, and to find out what they might be thinking about our economy and what policy changes they might make, we turn to David Wessel. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
You know, let's start with that whole question of Greece's financial troubles. Are they affecting the U.S. at all, or is it just all about Europe?
Well, Renee, what happens in Europe doesn't stay in Europe. Europe is an economy now as big as the United States, and when they are in bad shape, it's hard for us to sell our exports there. We've seen already that the European crisis is weakening the euro, their currency, that helps them export. For us, it's meant a huge flow of money to the United States. People are afraid of having their money in European government debt. They put it here. That makes it easier for us to finance our massive deficits. But I think the biggest impact you could see yesterday in the stock market in the U.S., today in Japan, that this whiff of crisis and of things spreading from Greece to Portugal is kind of unsettling. Uncertainty is unsettling. And so it is really making people a little nervous about the strength of our own recovery.
Although the U.S. economy is showing signs of positive signs. Home sales are up. Manufacturing is up. The economy seems to be growing again. Might that affect the Fed's deliberations today?
Well, it's certainly something they're going to be talking about. I think you would say that the Fed is encouraged by the economy, but not complacent. You're absolutely right. There have been a number of encouraging signs. On Friday, we expect to hear from the government that the U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of better than 3% in the first quarter. But that's not good enough to bring down unemployment. The Fed still has to worry about the massive tax increases and spending cuts going on in state and local governments. And, of course, housing is not good yet. Housing prices are a little bit higher than last year, but there's this massive supply of houses that banks own or will own, and they're going to come on the market at some point, and the Fed and others are worried that that will depress housing prices and constrain the recovery. So for today, I think that means pretty clearly they're not going to raise interest rates from where they are, basically zero, and they're not going to give any hint that an interest rate increase is imminent.
Well, you know, how long do you expect the Fed to keep holding rates near zero, given that the U.S. economy does seem, at least gradually, to be returning to something approaching normal?
Well, it really depends on how well the economy does. The current betting is that the Fed will be sitting on its hands at least through the end of this year, and I think that's probably right, unless the economy takes a sudden turn for the better.
What's the impact zero interest rates in the U.S. is having on the rest of the world? I mean, are they getting loans, the benefit of those interest rates?
That's a really good question. You know, the officials from around the world met in the United States for the International Monetary Fund meetings, and while the Europeans were focused on Greece, people from emerging markets in Asia and Latin America were focused just on your question. Basically, what's happening is that global investors are borrowing money in dollars at low rates, investing it in stocks and real estate in South Korea, Singapore, Brazil, and India. That's driving up their stock markets, their property markets, pushing up their currencies, and making them worry that they're at risk of having a bubble. So there's all sorts of talk about, should they do something to stop this money from coming in? Flows to emerging markets are up a third this year over last year. So it's really screwing up their economies a little bit, too.
David, good to talk to you again.
A pleasure.
David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. Talk about tough challenges. In Washington, D.C., there's a new commission with a seemingly impossible task, figuring out how to tame the federal debt. President Obama says all options are on the table. He ordered the commission to study the problem after the Senate refused to set up a similar panel that might have actually forced action by the government. NPR's Scott Horsley explains.
The 18 members of the new fiscal commission had barely sat down for their first meeting when they got a stern warning from the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Ben Bernanke says unless the federal government gets control of its mounting debt, the U.S. will face higher interest rates and eventually the threat of a crippling loss of confidence.
Achieving long-term fiscal sustainability will be difficult, but the costs of failing to do so could be very high.
Robert Reichauer has spent decades studying the government's red ink as former director of the Congressional Budget Office. He told the commissioners there's no easy fix.
Don't waste time looking for silver bullets or new approaches that hold out the promise of painless sacrifice. There are none to be found.
Most experts say getting a handle on the federal debt will require an unpleasant combination of cuts to popular programs, such as Social Security, and broad-based tax increases. Congressional Democrats typically resist the spending cuts, while Republicans fight the tax hikes. President Obama promised during the campaign not to raise taxes on any family making less than $250,000 a year. But yesterday, Mr. Obama refused to rule out any deficit-reducing option.
That's an old Washington game, and it's one that has made it all but impossible in the past for people to sit down and have an honest discussion about putting our country on a more secure fiscal footing. So I want to deliver this message today. We're not playing that game.
With the president insisting all options are on the table, activists on the left and the right are sounding preemptive alarms. Co-chairman and former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson tried to defend the commission from attacks by his fellow Republicans.
The minute we hit it, the shriek went up, ah, here they are. They're stalking horses for taxes. Well, I can tell you, we're stalking horses for our grandchildren.
Any recommendations by the commission must be approved by 14 of the 18 members, and even then, they're non-binding. The commission could provide some political cover for lawmakers casting difficult votes, but the first meeting showed how hard it may be to reach any consensus. Illinois Democrat Jan Schakowsky argued the government can't afford to cut spending on Social Security, while Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling insisted higher taxes would downsize the American dream. Still, commission members promised to keep open minds. Co-chair Erskine Bowles said nobody believes the government can continue on its current path.
We're on autopilot right now, and if we don't face up to these deficits, we will have a tremendous economic crisis. So we all get it. Now do we have the courage to do something?
The commission meets again next month. Its recommendations are due in December, after the midterm elections. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. President Obama is wrapping up his tour of the rural Midwest today. The two-day campaign-style itinerary includes stops in Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois. The focus of this tour is rural America. Many of the events have focused on clean energy, and NPR's Ari Shapiro joins us now to discuss the president's tour. Ari, tell us about the first stop the president made this afternoon.
Well, he stopped at a biorefining facility in Macon, Missouri. It's called POET, and it's a factory where they turn corn into ethanol. It is part of the clean energy theme of this tour through rural America. Really, the most striking thing about the plant when we got out of the motorcade was the overwhelming yeasty smell, almost like bread rising. President Obama spoke to a crowd of employees in front of a big tractor full of what looked like corn kernels, and he said this factory is part of what he envisions as a new clean energy economy for rural America. Here's what he said.
Well, I've said before, I don't accept second place for the United States of America. I want us to be first in wind power, first in solar power, and I want us to be first when it comes to biodiesel and the technologies that are being developed in places like POET.
Given that he was a senator who hailed from the state of Illinois and is quite familiar with ethanol and biofuel issues, I guess it's not surprising that this would be the focus.
That's right. He brought that up, that he had experience from this going back to his days as a senator in Illinois. And biofuel is not the only focus. Yesterday, he spoke at a wind turbine factory in Iowa, which gets 20% of its power from wind, more than any other state. And the reason he spoke at this wind turbine factory was that it had received more than $3.5 million in tax credits through the Recovery Act. So he says the Recovery Act was responsible not only for bringing clean energy to this part of Iowa, but also for providing more than 600 jobs that wouldn't have existed otherwise.
Ari, why is this issue of clean energy the focus of a tour that moves through rural America?
Well, it all comes back to the rural economy. This was a question that I asked Bill Burton, the White House spokesman who's traveling on this tour, and here's the answer he gave me aboard Air Force One this morning.
If you look at the long arc of the economy in rural America, as farms became more and more productive, you frankly have needed less and less farmers. So as a result, farm incomes have been going down, and a lot of the young folks in farm families have been moving away. But by creating real investment in biofuels, what you do is you can increase wages for farmers, strengthen the communities, all while keeping wages up and keeping folks in these areas.
So the administration sees clean energy as sort of a 1-2 punch. You can both boost jobs in rural America and you can get the U.S. off foreign oil dependence. And it certainly doesn't hurt the White House that this push comes in the wake of two disasters related to old-fashioned energy policies. There was, of course, the coal mine tragedy in West Virginia and the oil rig that sank in the Gulf of Mexico, both of which give the administration's clean energy push a little bit more momentum.
That's NPR's Ari Shapiro. He's traveling with the president throughout the Midwest. Ari, thank you very much.
You're welcome.